and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, a phase one trade deal between the U.S. and China is signed, at last, and earnings season has begun, with the banks the first to report. Our guests share their takes.
And of course, we'll close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. Sorry, I've got some bad news for you about the crazy things. I won again. I don't even have to hear yours. I know I won.
As soon as you said bad news, I knew that's what you would say.
Yeah.
But we'll see about that. Last week, okay. You really brought it. We'll see about it this time. And remember, you can always give us a call at our very own Bloomberg podcast hotline. That number is 646-324-3490. Tell us about the craziest things you've seen in markets or ask us a question and maybe we'll even play your message on the show.
You know, Sarah, as you said, it was quite a busy week in news flow and markets this week. So luckily we have some very great guests to break it all down for us. Joining us for the first time on the show is the chief U.S. equity strategist at Credit Suisse, Jonathan Golub. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Sarah, also, it was a big bank earnings week, as you mentioned. I will tell you this, I did not really pay much attention to them, and you know why that is?
Because we have a great guest who's going to tell you all about them right now.
That's right, because our own Bloomberg reporter, Lenan Nguyen, covers banks very closely, and I figured I'd just let her read the bank earnings so I don't have to.
Happy to help.
All right, good.
That's what you're here for, right?
So, John, let's start with you. One of the notes you had out recently caught my eye. You're talking about this new product you have at the research desk at Credit Suisse. Let me just read the introduction to it. Over 150 years ago, British mathematician Ada Lovelace introduced the world to what would later become computer programming. First of all, I did not realize that 150 years ago. That's amazing that that was the seeds of computer programming.
And the fact that it was a female mathematician is quite amazing
as well.
Ahead of her times.
Fascinating. So in her honor, we introduce Ada, the next generation of factor research. What makes Ada different is the sophistication of her methods and the simplicity of her insights into market behavior. So you and then you went on to write a big report about some of the findings of this. But I'm curious, if I'm a client, is my relationship with Ada basically your reports, or is there an interface people will be able to use eventually?
At this point, it's almost a personal relationship. And what I mean by that is it depends on what your take. So the way this whole thing started was that investors were calling and said, I'm an energy investor. I've gotten my calls right on the earnings. I got my call right on the price of oil, and I'm underperforming the market. My stocks aren't doing what they're supposed to do. What gives here? And so what we did is we took factor research and we applied it at the company level to say, what is the market actually rewarding in energy or in value stocks or in a dividend yield portfolio? And that's what the genesis of this was. And it's the reception has been fantastic.
You hinted at what makes you different, and you said the reception has been fantastic. But before we get into some of the more macro findings, the points of what you found with Ada, do you find that it's difficult right now? We've heard time and again that quant investing, factor investing is really difficult. We've seen the likes of AQR cutting some of its workforce. We've seen redemptions from some of the most popular quant funds out there. I mean, how can you actually go about using factors and do it well?
I'm not expecting people to simply say Ada, or which is kind of the way we talk about it. Ada is telling me to be in high dividend yielding stocks, so that's what I'm going to do. What it's saying is, all else being equal, this is where the market's going to pay you. Here are the companies that are the most levered or most exposed to those characteristics. Now let's start a conversation from, these are the high dividend paying stocks within the staple space. The market's rewarding it. Here's why. Now go and start to do your work. So you're starting where the wind is in your sails. So in many ways, it's very different than what you would get from an AQR, where they're really depending on using them as an example, but where they're really depending on the quant to be the portfolio. This is really a tool.
One line in this report I really struck home with me is you talk about sector biases. You say sectors are naturally exposed to specific characteristics. For example, utilities tend to have higher dividend yields than the broad market, and by extension, a high dividend yield basket will tend to be overweight utilities. I think this is really important because all throughout last year, you know, when people are rotating from growth to value, you know, as kind of an old man looking at the market, I was going, well, no, they're rotating out of tech and into banks or into energy. So I'm curious, like, how much of the market's motivations do you think, of investors' motivations, still cling to those old sort of ideas of I'm going to buy this sector rather than I'm going to buy the factor?
Well, you're actually asking several questions. So
I tend to do that. Yeah.
So let me you know, if we start at the more, maybe, you know, the biggest issue is that we have this perception that certain investment characteristics are good and others are bad. So we like high quality portfolios. We like stocks that don't have a lot of debt. We like stocks with growth and big global footprints. But every one of those characteristics does well or poorly in certain situations. I'll give you an example. Right now, companies with deteriorating fundamentals that are heavily shorted are outperforming the market. And you wouldn't normally think that because it would sound like they're negative characteristics. Yeah. And what the key here is to say, I'm not coming in with any bias. Let me, you know, if I have an opinion on what types of things I think are going to happen, or if I'm looking at trends, I want to start by saying, I don't care. All I want to do here is make money in the markets. Now tell me what the best way to do that is.
So that phenomenon you just mentioned, is that a function of short covering, you think, or is it the notion that the economic data is turning around, going to start firming up a little bit, or maybe a combination of both?
No, it's the latter point. And I think that people miss this. Think about a shorted company. Is a company that in some way is broken. It's some hedge fund somewhere thinks this is a company that may go bankrupt.
Right.
And if the economy is weak, which it was, let's say, you know, for the majority of the last 18 months or so, then a broken company and a weak economy, bad news. All of a sudden, if the economy is getting better, they're going to get pulled away from the precipice and things are going to get better for them. And they're going to actually improve more than a really healthy company. And this is really frustrating for investors with a quality bias. They're like, I bought the best company. They don't have, you know, debt on their balance sheet. Their businesses run really clean.
I did everything right.
And an improving economy. And they're getting less in the dust by this broken company with bad management. And that's the whole point. Their bias towards quality is a dangerous bias if it's not put in context.
I do want to pick up on a point of one of the questions that Mike just
recently
asked.
I got a few more I could throw in there.
Yeah. But about the fact that factors don't necessarily equate to particular sectors. In fact, across sectors, you can find different factors. And you have a very interesting chart. And I find it interesting because in my reporting last year about low volatility, people constantly looked at low volatility and said, well, low volatility is doing well because utilities, real estate, consumer staples are doing well. But what you actually find is that the areas of low volatility, the pockets of that factor that actually did well, were in cyclical areas, the likes of financials, energy. Can you maybe dive a bit deeper into this difference, break down the idea that factors aren't just sectors. It can go across.
So Sarah, one of the things that we start with is that we look at the factor or these basic, what's a factor? It's just companies that are tilted towards a certain behavior. And we look at them and say, I want to eliminate the sector issues. So if we're looking at low vol, I say, what do low vol banks do compared to high vol banks? What do low vol staples do compared to, you know, other staples? And what we found is that the area that low vol did the best in were the most high vol parts of the market. So in energy and materials and discretionary in banks, where you'd say, well, low vol didn't do well there. But in fact, that's where really the juice was on this trade. So yes, utilities and staples and telcos did well. But if you were a professional investor who was looking at this kind of work, you would have played it entirely differently.
You know, John, when I walked in here, you were going through some charts with Sarah. I think you predicted the ISM manufacturing could hit 52 in a few months, and there's a trade involved in that.
So here's what the background is, that the what we call the ISM is a survey. So they ask a bunch of people who buy equipment for factories, their purchasing managers, and they say, how do you think it's going? Are you seeing demand for equipment? Are you able to get the equipment or the parts that you need? And from that, they derive this score on how good the economy is. And typically, what they're reading is lines up pretty well with how the industrial data is coming in, you know, shipments and things like that. And right now, the economy is saying that things are okay, and the ISM survey is saying things are totally broken. The gap is about as wide as it's ever been. And so the question is, why and how does that resolve? Because these gaps, they're going to close either because the economy is going to follow the ISM down and do poorly, or the ISM is magically going to go up. the guy who's buying the equipment for his factory is totally freaked out by trade issues. So when he's asked, how do you think it's going? All he's saying is, I'm never going to get these parts because they were manufactured in China. So I'm really concerned. Now that we have this trade deal done, now that we're starting to see a pickup in some of the economic data, especially in Europe and China, in their domestic economies, my belief, and the data says, that it's not that the industrial data is going to get worse. It's that the survey data is going to get better. And what does that do? Is it pushes stocks up, but it pushes more cyclical companies and it pushes lower quality companies like those shorted kind of stocks that we're talking about. Those end up leading in that environment.
Lynann, I want to bring you in here because we did hear from the likes of the largest U.S. banks this week, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, you name it. On a macro level to start off, do you get the sense, similar to what Jonathan is saying, that the macro outlook is still strong, the consumer still looks strong, at least from the bank's perspective?
Yes, definitely, Sarah. So throughout this whole period when everyone's freaking out about trade or recession concerns, the bank CEOs have all been very bullish. They've all talked about the positive U.S. consumer driving a lot of business, still not really being harmed by all the uncertainties and the macro sort of concerns. So, yeah, they've been pretty optimistic and they haven't really turned more pessimistic as of this quarter.
One thing I love to look at bank earnings for is the credit quality trends. And I don't know, for years now, everyone has, and their brother's been predicting, oh, they're about to turn. They're about to, you know, the credit quality is about to
deteriorate.
Yeah. What are you seeing as far as, you know, delinquencies and that sort of thing?
Still very good credit quality. Not a huge deterioration. We are looking at those numbers very closely. At Bank of America, the consumer business started to do a little bit worse, but that's not really a credit issue. It's more that they're earning less because of interest rate cuts by the Fed. So we're keeping an eye on it, but so far they've done pretty well with credit.
Just a quick question, because we do a lot of work looking at the earnings data across banks. But if you break the banks into two groups, which is the big money center banks and then the regional banks, and putting aside some company specific issues, but the big money center banks, the Wall Street banks, are expected to deliver much, much better results, and the regional banks, not as much. Any thoughts on what's causing those differences and how that plays out?
The big banks would be so happy that you said that. So I think a lot of it comes down to digital and to technology. The big banks have a lot of money to spend on these tools. They have a lot of money to really dive into that digital mobile app stuff. And so they're really making the bank much more efficient. They're making sure that consumers don't call, you know, a phone line to ask for their balance and instead are doing everything by phone, you know, by their mobile app. And so they're really pushing into a lot of efficiency because they can make that investment in technology.
See, I would have guessed the interest rate scenario is part of it, too. You know, your regional banks are more sort of saving loan type
lending
of businesses, and the big ones are more diversified. Is that, am I just...
Definitely.
Yeah, part
yep.
of it?
Yeah. More diversified, and for now have not seen a massive impact from the Fed's rate cuts, but that's coming.
Right. Well, you also even just look at this past quarter, for example, and you saw such a major boost from trading desks at the major banks, which isn't necessarily something that your regional banks would be doing either, right?
No, and we've been talking a long time about the structural decline in trading and whether, you know, this is just a trend that's going to keep continuing, but the FIC traders got a break this quarter. So bond traders, let me just give you a few metrics here. JP Morgan came in $1 billion higher than analysts predicted. Goldman Sachs, 63% surge in FIC trading. And Morgan Stanley more than doubled from a year earlier.
Well,
so
part
these
of that's
are
the,
huge...
the easy comparison to 18, right? I mean,
Definitely.
The narrative then was that all the clients were sitting on their hands, not trading anything because
yeah.
it looked like the world was ending.
Yeah, and now they've run to the other side of the boat and they said, oh, everything's fine. Trade's going to be worked out. And so let's trade. Let's do a lot of business. Let's trade a lot of bonds, rates, mortgages.
John, I'm going to pack in about 5 questions off of what Lynann just had to say. All right, so you
pick
ready?
The
you
want one
to take,
that you want to
answer. You can take notes, like you know, you see Powell take notes in the. No, but I wonder if you do buy into that notion that credit sort of leads the equity market. It's one of these common tropes you hear all the time. I'm curious if it's one that's worth believing, and if so, sort of where do you look first for that deterioration? You know, is it in the consumer end if you start to see jobless claims pick up? Is it sort of something that you just can't predict?
You're right. You asked five questions. So let me go and reframe it into the question I want to answer. I've been through media training. So anyway, but the you know so
you're not supposed to admit that out loud.
The question is, what would basically make things deteriorate from here? What can go wrong that would be problematic? And I think that there's two things, and we're seeing neither one of them. But the first thing is that everyone's assuming right now that inflation will not be a problem over the next year, and that even though we have a tight labor market, and even though we're probably going to see an incremental pickup in inflation, it's going to be nothing which is going to freak the Fed out or really spook the market. Now, if you ask me whether I agree with that consensus view, sometimes I do, I don't. But right now, I absolutely do. Mm-hmm. I think that it's going to stay contained, and that's going to be really healthy. The second issue is if you look at, and there's two different kinds of jobs data. There's, are we hiring people and are we firing people? We care about both, but we really care about the fires. And so what we're seeing is the weekly jobless claims, which is that read, just keeps getting lower and lower. And all indications are that it's going to stay healthy. But if that turned, it's, you know, if we look at the two things that typically tell you that there's a real problem, the first one everybody focuses on is the yield curve. And we talked about that last year quite a bit. But probably the one that's more important, if you see the weekly jobless claims kind of spike up, watch out. That's a problem. But right now we're not seeing that. So those are the things that matter.
You know, it's funny about inflation. Everyone came out saying, oh, this was a weaker than expected CPI report this week. Core CPI was still 2.3%, you know. So I wonder if part of it is that everyone has sort of recalibrated their expectations of the Fed to some degree, the symmetry of that target, that they will allow it to run a little hot. And I know they look at PCE more than CPI, but they will, you know, allow a breach of 2%, maybe a little higher than what people had previously expected.
Well, if first of all, as you said, you know, PCE is what the Fed looks at. And for those people here who don't like follow the jargon on what's PCE and CPI, so you go to the grocery store and you realize that butter is doubled in price. So, you know, is that inflation? It is if you actually buy butter at twice the price. But if you do what most of us would do, we'd say, wow, butter's expensive. I'll buy olive oil, which has not gone up in price, then you didn't experience any inflation.
Yeah, the substitution.
You substitute things out. And so there's, if you look at it in that context, which is overall, am I paying more money when I go to the grocery store to get the groceries that I need? That number is still a really low number. And the Fed, if they say, not that the 2%, and we think that 2% is a ceiling, it's not. If it's kind of a central tendency or you know, your target, then we're not even close to two, let alone that being an average over a period of years. So there's really, at this point, not a lot of threat, even though some of these readings are tipping up a little bit.
All right. So if we set the backdrop based on this conversation we're having, the economy is healthy, turning to the upside, inflation is muted, interest rates are low. So at the end of last year, as we were discussing earlier, we saw the value trade take off. This year so far, it's been completely squashed. It's as if we're back to the beginning of 2019. Bigger is better. You see the FANGs doing well, Apple doing well. From your point of view, especially using the technology that you guys have been using to dissect all of this, is the value trade over? Can you know yet? And if not, where can you squeeze some more juice out of it?
Right. So I think there's two issues here. When you call it the value trade, you're kind of taking a whole bunch of things and you're squishing them to value. Mm-hmm. So if you said, are low PE stocks that underperformed by 10% over the last, you know, let's say year to 18 months that have jumped in the fourth quarter by roughly 10%, is that part of the trade mostly over? I think the answer is yes. However, if you look at the same issue with small caps, it looks like they have a lot more room to run. If you look at non-U.S. companies, so Europe relative to the U.S., more to run. Emerging markets, more to run. So you almost need to, not you almost, you absolutely need to look at this in more individual slices because they're not all the same. But in terms of how long does this continue to go for, our take is probably something in the 3 to 6 month range. This is not a new world where the economy is going to take off and the like. This is a near term trade. It's a bounce. If you're a stock trader, this is super important. If you're a long term investor, probably less so.
You know, I think one consensus or near consensus from a lot of the sort of look ahead pieces I read at the end of the year from people like you was, and I'm not sure if you came out and said this yourself, but the numbers kind of imply that valuation expansion was a big story last year from the index level. Not a lot of people expect more expansion in PEs this year from the macro level. Is there a chance of that surprising people? You know, is the trade deal kind of a catalyst for some more frothy valuations?
So one of the things that we try to do is to take what we call the consensus narrative, this thing that we all believe, not because we actually ran the numbers, but because it sounds logical.
I heard it enough.
So the market was up 29.5% last year. You add dividends is up 31.5%. Stocks must be expensive. And we do know in that environment, we actually had near zero EPS growth. So obviously something was going on. However, if you look at what really happened was you had a really horrible fourth quarter of 18, and the majority of last year's return was simply reversing the fourth quarter. So if you instead looked at 18 and 19 combined, what you actually found was the entire market run over the 2 years was driven by earnings, and multiples actually were down a tiny bit. Now, if you look at that really great return that you had over 18 and 19 coming from earnings, about 40-50% of it was, well, maybe a little less than 50, but about 40% of it was from the tax cuts, mm-hmm. which is not going to repeat itself. So if you take out the tax cuts, you're left with something which was like 5% a year on earnings. So I think that people are misframing it because it's convenient to do. Now, if you look at why, and we believe actually that multiples are going to drift, not immediately, but over 20. Right now, a forward PE is about 18. And the reason is, first of all, interest rates are super low. And the second thing is that companies are returning a crazy amount of cash back to shareholders. What they're being rewarded for is not hoarding the money and making bad investments with it, but simply returning it back. And I think that many are making a mistake to be concerned that higher than average multiples does not mean that they can't go higher anyway.
Right, right. Yeah, the valuations don't ever sort of ring the top of a market, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to come a certain level that you're going to say, listen, I'm just uncomfortable with this. But if normally PEs run at 15 and now they're running at 18, but companies are returning twice as much capital mm-hmm. and interest rates are half the level, I just think that we're really far away from where multiples are going.
Can I make a point on tax cuts? Also, one of our colleagues wrote a great story about how the banks got $18 billion in tax cuts from the Trump tax plan last year.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So do we know how that, well, obviously it would have helped profits, but.
Yes. And so now the total effect is $32 billion. Chunky.
Wow. It, all of tax,
all told,
all from
yep.
taxes? Wow.
Yep, for the big six banks.
Speaking of benefits to banks, I just want to get your take because something that was very noticeable this week while we were awaiting the signing of the phase one trade deal between the U.S. and China, and President Trump was running through the roll call of everyone who was at the event to witness the signing, there were a lot of big bank executives there, or at least a lot of people in the financial services industry. So I want to get your take. Is there something about this trade deal that is supposed to really help, or will it actually benefit the financial services industry?
Yeah, it was a funny moment when Trump asked or said that the banks should say thank you to him. He was speaking to a J.P. Morgan executive. That was hilarious. Yeah, I mean, the banks are all very keen to get bigger in China. Goldman Sachs, prior to the trade deal, was already saying that it wanted to double its amount of staffing in China. The question now is whether they can deepen their impact because they already have to have these kind of JV structures. So if you were in a JV with a big American bank, would you just be like, okay, fine, I'll sell everything and you can take over? You know, that's a negotiation.
Theoretically, they can now have a wholly owned subsidiary.
Exactly. And so the question is whether the partners are actually going to be okay with that, mm-hmm. whether the banks can kind of, you know, broaden or widen their stake in some of these entities. So,
and does the partnership kind of gain them entrance into the...
Exactly. There is something to be said for a local partnership because it gives you local trust and a name brand and something that you can kind of get a toehold in. So are Chinese consumers going to be happy with, you know, Goldman Sachs brand, or do they want a local firm that kind of you know, opens the door?
Maybe they buy 1% and go 51-49 versus 50-50.
Yeah, it remains to be seen. I'm sure that everyone is kind of looking at their businesses and figuring out what to do, trying to start those negotiations because now it's green light.
I think that's our green light for the craziest thing of the week.
I believe so.
John's impressed with that segue, I can tell over there.
Because he's had media training, he knows.
He knows. Quick pivot?
Yeah,
that
was a good pivot.
All right. Lanon already told me that her craziest thing is one of her own stories, which I'll allow.
It's so self-serving, but I got to do it because this story really touched a nerve. I wrote a story about how Wall Street's bonus culture is dying because of the quants, right? Because
John's like, wait a minute.
what are you talking about?
you're catering to quant clients, I'm sure. And so these days, you know, the quants and the robots and automation, it's doing much more of the work that the traditional old school trader used to do. And so that kind of means that cost pressure and team dynamics now are really important rather than just the one trader saying, I'm going to make a big bet and I'm going to make tons of money. Really touched a nerve. Got a lot of reader emails lamenting the good old days, saying, oh no, I need to go and take a coding class. So that was the craziest thing. I just didn't anticipate this type of reaction that people would really, you know, unleash their kind of angst on me after I published the story.
And the amount of feedback that you get.
Yeah.
I think when you're telling someone that part of their job or part of their pay is at threat, they might not be too happy with you.
They were not happy.
All right, Sarah, can you beat that?
All right, so this week I'm leaning back on just some of the old classics because how could I not? If you look at shares of Tesla or you look at shares of Beyond Meat this year, it's really just unbelievable. So shares of Beyond Meat up about 50% this year. Shares of Tesla up about 20% year to date. And these are companies that had some struggles a couple months back. But now they're back and they're very hot. And yes, there has been news flow to help these gains and kind of inspire these gains. But at the same time, just the sheer strength of what we've seen has been pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's not bad.
They're just classics that you can run with.
John, did they tell you about our gimmick here, the craziest thing we saw in markets this week?
Well, I'll wing it. We did analysis of the fourth quarter expected earnings. This is just consensus expectations and for the fourth quarter and then all of 2020. And the expectation is that 2020 is going to be a massive rebound. And everyone kind of wrote off the earnings story because you had no earnings to speak of in 2019. And what the so first, to your point on trade, the biggest change is those S&P companies that are doing the majority of their business outside of the U.S., the numbers are like double-digit growth expectations for next year. However, the current quarter is going to see none of that because we are still seeing, and you talked about things being good in the banks, but the industrial companies, the material companies, the energy companies, and even some of the big tech companies are really expected to have a weak quarter. So this is going to be a, you know, surprisingly weak quarter with unbelievably strong expectations for next year. And what I'm hearing when I talk to investors is they're struggling with buying into this story. They want to believe things are going to get better, but they're hugely skeptical, which to me is actually an opportunity.
Mm. So you think, is it possible we actually see double-digit earnings growth for the benchmark this year?
No, you're not going to see you're not going to see double-digit for the benchmark. But what you will see is, so take energy, for example. It subtracted like 2% from earnings last year for the whole S&P and had a horrible number. It's going to have super easy comps. So energy is going to put up in 2020 on a growth rate compared to the prior year. Huge numbers. Mm-hmm. The big tech companies that were faced with either a semiconductor cycle or internet issues had really huge margin pressures and costs in 2019. And so they're set up to put up really, really big relative gains in the year. So the delta on this is going to be energy, mega cap tech are going to be just they're going to be double digit winners. And I think that there's this skepticism of people buying into that success.
Plenty.
All right,
Mike, you talked a big game, so I have to bring it.
Now time for the winning entry in the craziest thing. Well, first, before I get to that, let me start with a friend of mine texted me with his entry. He warned, though, that I can't think of a market angle on this one. So maybe if any
Do
listeners...
Do you always have a friend who calls in with something?
A friend was a problem.
Asking for a friend. Exactly. Yeah.
But so if anyone can think of a market angle for this story, it is crazy.
So it's just flat out crazy.
Yeah, but okay. Call the hotline if you got a market angle. But it's a man, this is a story from the Des Moines Register. I think I saw it a few other places too. Man going through a nasty divorce with his wife.
He petitioned the judge to do it by trial by combat. He basically wants to have a sword fight with his wife. And according to this guy, trial by combat has never officially been outlawed. You can still request it. I don't know. I think he's watching too much Game of Thrones.
I think your friend wins.
So
this
far,
even
no, going
no,
way
you need the
back.
Market angle first. I'll allow him to win if we can figure the market
this
angle.
This is going back before duels. He's going way, way back.
Right, trading by combat. I don't know.
But here's my craziest thing of the week, courtesy of the CoinDesk website via the Money Stuff newsletter, which I find a lot of crazy things in. Some people have launched a new cryptocurrency backed by tins of sardines. First, the reporter, I think, thought it was a joke because it mentioned April 1 in the white paper about it. But no, this is a real thing. And I looked it up. I did some research. And by that, I mean, I Googled vintage sardines. Apparently, John, sardines are an appreciating asset. There are some aficionados, if you follow me. Who believe it's like
no
fine wine. That sardines,
a delayed laugh.
Sardines appreciate. They taste better after a few years. Tins of sardines appreciate in value like a fine wine. I know. It sounds crazy.
Until when?
And I don't know. It's a good question.
There's got to be a
spoil. Come on.
There's
got to be an expiration date.
But so this cryptocurrency would buy tins of sardines, store them, and that's what underpins the value. It actually might be the first cryptocurrency that makes sense to me, to be honest.
Sadly. Look, I'm going to say that is crazy, but considering the fact that when we first started this podcast, you flat out said to me, we cannot talk about crypto. I think you might be disqualified.
Oh, jeez, you're right.
Yeah.
Darn it.
You went against your own
rules.
We've
broken that rule, though.
We've already broken the rule many times. So.
The sardine's exception to the crypto rule.
They are. You're a sardine aficionado. But with that said, Jonathan Golub, Lynann Nguyen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
What Goes Out will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reaganonymous. Our guest, Lynann Nguyen, is at Lynann T. Nguyen. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges and edited by Jarrell Dillard. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.